Friday's weekend edition of Connecticut Today on January 27th, 2023, featured transportation and commuter advocate our buddy Jim Cameron talking about the state's latest issues on the roads and the rails and whether or not Metro North actually cares or listens to its riders. We also welcomed retired Colonel Mark C. Vlahos of the Air Force, author of Leading the Way to Victory, a history of the 60th Troop Carrier Group, 1940 to 1945, one of those little-known stories about World War II. We'd like to check in with this gentleman on a regular basis. He's the founder of the Commuter Action Group, advocates for Connecticut rail riders. We often talk about his weekly column called Talking Transportation. He's in the Connecticut Mirror and other places of interest. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Jim Cameron is with us. Mr. Cameron, sir, good afternoon. I hope the intro was befitting of your stature, sir. How are you?
Oh, my head is swollen. I don't think I can keep my headset on. That's very kind.
You used a great word in your latest column, Talking Transportation, of course, in the Connecticut Mirror and other spots. Connecticut's transportation obfuscation, Mr. Cameron. Normally, you don't pull punches, and you're not pulling punches in this column either. You're not too happy about a couple things here, are you?
Obfuscation, for your benefit, Paul, because I know it's kind of a big word, means hiding things. It means concealing things. And the purpose of this particular column was to call out efforts to suppress legitimate criticism of Metro North and the Department of Transportation by the Commuter Rail Council. Now, this is a supposedly independent watchdog group. It was created by the legislature almost 40 years ago. I served on it for 19 years until Governor Malloy didn't like the criticism that we were making of the way he was operating the trains through the DOT. Mm-hmm. And a senior lawmaker took me aside and along with another council member said, cool it or we're going to write your little commuter council out of existence.
Jeez.
And they did just that. They eliminated the commuter council, created a new watered-down version, and to their credit, the guy that took over from me, Jim Gilday, who's the chairman of the commuter council, has been a great advocate. You know, he came straight from my playbook in terms of speaking truth to power, asking for better service, asking for information about on-time performance and ridership numbers and things like that. Mm-hmm. But getting no cooperation from the agencies that are supposed to be helping them out in terms of giving information when requested. So he went and testified in front of the Transportation Committee and said, hey, folks, I'm not getting the cooperation. The council's not getting the cooperation we need. We're supposed to be there advocating for riders, and they're just stonewalling us. They're hiding things. We've asked for 5 months for information on ridership numbers. And they just keep saying, we got to get back to you on that one. And they never do. So that's what obfuscation of transportation means. And that's what that column was about.
Well, and Jim, what is the request here? I mean, is it for state secrets? I don't think we're talking about the stuff that are, you know, found in the office of current or ex-presidents of either party here. What is this cloak and dagger information that is so hard to get, Mr. Cameron? I'm lost here on this. What in the heck are you asking for, Jim?
Well, they were asking for, I thought, very reasonable information, like what's the ridership at various stations along the line? The DOT, you were promoting this new super express service, 99 minutes to get you from New Haven to Grand Central. What's the ridership on that? You know, you've been talking about this, but has anybody been taking those trains? When are we going to get full service restored on Shoreline East? Those are the trains that run from New Haven all the way east to New London. Legitimate requests, but nothing but stonewalling from the Department of Transportation and from Metro North, I might add, as well, too.
And, you know, Jim, the sad thing is, you know, I read this from afar. You're in the middle of this still after all these years. And it sure reeks to me, Jim Cameron, of just to me, maybe to anybody else, I don't know, of a scenario where an organization says, well, all right, go pound sand because we're the only method you have to ride those rails. There's no competition. And so we'll do what we want to do when we want to do it.
That's another word, which was in one of my earlier columns, called a monopoly. I mean, it's not like you have a choice. If you're going to take a train, it's got to be Metro North, or it's got to be the Hartford line or Shoreline East. There is no competition. And I think, you know, I doubt that there's going to be, given the losses that Metro North is suffering through, I doubt that there's going to be anybody with a brain that would say, yeah, let's compete against Metro North. By the way, they own the tracks, and you got to get permission from them to run your little trains on their tracks. I think it's the mentality. And stay tuned. You're going to hear something next week that's going to echo all of this, because there is another move afoot now that the commuter council has been, asking questions, not getting answers, raising this issue in public. Those agencies don't like that. And I think you're going to find, surprise, surprise, there's a new bill in the hopper to do away with the council once again. And
really?
Replace it with something else.
And who might be, Mr. Cameron, or you can keep us dangling here for the drama next week, might we know who might be this time behind the bill to get rid of the commuter council, or do we not know that?
Trust me, Dr. Pacelli, am doing my utmost to find the answer to that question. But, one of the things about the legislature is that anybody can slip a bill into the hopper, and they don't necessarily have to have their name or fingerprint on it. So I want to see who's going to take credit for this little move.
All right. I'm seeing here Jim Cameron. By the way, commuter advocate Jim Cameron is the guest, as we like check in with him every month or so. The quiet cars. Now, can I tell you something? I was still going into the city two or three days a week pre-COVID, I used to love the quiet cars, because there are some of us, Jim, as you know, who don't want to hear everybody's phone conversation, which is like 90 minutes of sweet quiet to read or to close our eyes. But the quiet cars, the quiet cars are gone? Really?
Well, to their credit, the commuter council was asking about that for months and months. They've been gone since the pandemic. The railroad argued, we want to give people room to spread out, and it's only you few wackos that want to sit in a quiet car. And more importantly, the final answer they gave to the commuter council was, no, we're not going to restore the quiet cars due to what they call operational issues. That's another one of those obfuscation words. It's two words that don't mean anything. What do you mean, operational issues?
Can I guess?
You can't put the quiet cars back? Yeah, well, go ahead, guess, because they weren't really too clear.
My guess is, Jim, and I see this on social media, my guess is I was in this car on Metro North the other day, and I was told that I couldn't laugh or talk out loud or play video games or crank the music because they have this thing called a quiet car. Who the hell wants to sit in a quiet car? And, Jim, I will bet you, and this is just my conjecture here, I will bet you that the conductors were getting hassled over it, and they may have said, hey, we're not the police on this train. I don't know. That's what I'm thinking.
I think it never even came to that, because I think that the real story is that the conductors did not want to enforce this rule.
Yeah.
And so they didn't enforce the rule. So the quiet cars weren't really quiet to begin with. And they used the pandemic as an excuse to get rid of them. This is at a time, remember, we're trying, the railroad's trying real hard, they say, to attract riders back onto the trains. The riders are not coming back. The deficits are ballooning extraordinarily. You know what that's going to mean? A fare increase.
Yes, and Jim,
here's a simple idea, a quiet car that might actually get people back on the train.
Yeah, and Jim, what I think is, and we go to another story now, you're quoted in this story about, the drive on 95 South, from Sherwood Island all the way down to Lower Fairfield County being the slowest in the nation, right? Jim, I'm telling you, it is And you kind of answered the question there. You know, why do people still put up with this when they could take the train? Well, Jim, I think some people, I could be wrong here, would rather put up with a half an hour delay every day because at least they consider the inside of their car their dominion. I don't know. The numbers are crazy, like you said, but maybe they just say, you know what, I want my music or I want my silence, whatever. But those numbers from that new study are wild.
Yeah, and it's, you know, nothing we don't already know. I mean, I heard your traffic report. You know, I listened to WICC, 45 minutes from Stanford to Bridgeport.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's only 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday, you know, and that's only going to get worse. Be careful what you wish for, though, Paul, because I don't want to lose your important traffic audience there. You know, people listen to you to hear, you know, how far is this traffic going to continue? I mean, is it going to open up after Westport? No. Going to be like this all the way up to Bridgeport, and the stress that induces on people, you know, whether if you're going to work and you've got to put up with that in the morning going in and you arrive at work, what kind of a mental state are you in as opposed to being able to sit on a train and it'd be nice to sit in a quiet car or at least sit in a car so you're not under that kind of stress and arrive in a somewhat refreshed manner to do your daily work. That would be a treat. That's the part I don't understand. I think people are inducing a lot of anguish and stress on themselves in the guise of saying, well, I don't want to share a seat next to some bozo on the train, or, you know, there's wackos riding Metro North these days. Well, you know, you get what you pay for.
That's right. His latest column, Connecticut's Transportation Obfuscation. Jim Cameron, Talking Transportation, as always. Check it out, Connecticut Mirror and other spots as well. Jim, thank you. We'll talk to you down the road, my friend. Have a good weekend.
All right. You too.
All right, thank you, sir. Jim Cameron there. Go to the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org. He's in the Viewpoints section, Connecticut's Transportation. Boy, slow down, Paul. Rented lips today. Connecticut's Transportation Obfuscation. Yes. All right, we'll get back to all the current event stuff, which is not the easiest stuff to talk about later on in the show. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. But it's a Friday, and, you know, every day during the week, or usually during the week, I like to have something that we can all relax and enjoy on Friday, maybe learn something. World War II history, still a big thing that we're constantly uncovering. Our next guest retired from the U.S. Air Force in 2011 during a 29-year career. He served in a wide range of operational flying and staff assignments, including commanding a C-130 squadron in combat and vice wing commander of the 314th Airlift Wing at Little Rock Air Force Base. We welcome Colonel Mark Vlahos to the program. Name of the book is Leading the Way to Victory, a history of the 60th Troop Carrier Group, 1940 to 1945. Colonel Vlahos, Paul here on WICC. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Cheers from Texas.
Well, thank you, and good to hear from the folks in Texas. You know, Colonel, I'm constantly fascinated because we think, don't we, some people, we know all about World War II. Oh, my father was there, or my grandfather was there, the stories they told me, and we have the History Channel, and we have National Geographic. But we seem to uncover more and more and more of these stories, Colonel, that I know you go into your book, and it kind of is this evolving history, isn't it? Talk about what you talk about in the book, and why'd you write it?
Hey, thanks, Paul. Well, I kind of went back to the roots of my career, C-130s. The C-47 aircraft, which was a gray aircraft, was the grandfather of the C-130. During my career, I met many pilots who flew and crew members from World War II who flew it in the 1980s and 90s, and they all passed, and we need to tell their stories and keep them alive. And it's just like you said, it's amazing. Most Americans are probably unaware we had glider pilots in World War II. And a big part of my book is writing about the gliders that the C-47s towed. And there is a lot that people can learn by studying World War II. You're exactly right. And the lessons we need to remember and not forget. And I do it to honor them, is why I do it, to honor the men and women who served in World War II.
And we should remind the folks there's a co-author on this book, too, Colonel Bill Keller, retired U.S. Air Force. So, Colonel Vallejos, 1942, the C-47, a new transport aircraft. Well, how was it developed, and what was the immediate reception here when the C-47 came online?
Sure, yeah. Well, my good friend Bill Keeler, who's a retired colonel, wrote the foreword. I'm actually the author of the book, but I'm grateful to Bill to write the foreword. But the C-47 was a great aircraft. It was based on the commercial DC-3 variant, which most people are probably familiar with, and it's still flying today. You still see DC-3s today. And with the brand-new evolving paratroop mission, dropping paratroopers, that is, and supplies, the C-47 took on that role, and it was greatly received by the pilots because it was a fantastic airplane to fly. It could fly about 1,500 miles on total range with extended engine tanks, and it could land. It was rugged. It could land on 3,000 feet on dirt, snow, ice, any unimproved surface. But mainly it was used, it could carry 14 to 18 paratroopers, and for the brand-new paratroop mission, that was a fantastic platform, jump platform that our airborne forces loved to jump out of, too.
Yeah. Now, Colonel, was the plane developed with all these things in mind? And you say there was a transport version of this, a civilian version, so this wasn't a clean sheet plane, but they knew what they needed an airplane for. Is that how this was done?
That's exactly. We knew we needed some type of transport aircraft, to keep the Army mobile, to go bring supplies to the Army. It was originally envisioned probably as just a transport, like you said, to carry supplies, air, land. But then the paratroop mission just evolved in 1940, and it became a jump platform. And the first gliders really weren't produced until 1941 for the military. So, again, when this plane was designed, no, towing gliders was not envisioned. So, you're right, it evolved. It was an evolving process as we needed to develop new systems, to fight combat and get our airborne forces to war.
Name of the book, Leading the Way to Victory, A History of the 60th Troop Carrier Group, 1940 to 1945. The author, Colonel Mark C. Vallejos, retired from the U.S. Air Force. A lot of oh, wow moments in this book, Colonel, while you were writing it and researching it. I see here you went through past historical materials, microfilm records from the Air Forces. Did you have a lot of that? I didn't know that while you wrote this?
Oh, yeah. A ton of it. I love research writing, Paul, because it's a journey, and I meet people along the way. Is when I write my books and research them, I reach out and try to find family members who had relatives in the unit when I research and author a book. This is my third book, by the way. And meeting those family members is part of the journey. They share pictures from their attic that obviously the public has never seen. And you talk about, oh, wow, there's a lot of, original unpublished pictures in this book. But just reading the firsthand accounts of the first combat paratroop drop in U.S. Army history, you're talking about an oh wow moment, or the first combat glider tow during the invasion of Sicily. Lots of oh wow moments, lots of first encountered. Really enjoyed, as I learned too, to write this book.
It is sad, though, isn't it, Colonel, that as the years go on, and I don't know what the rough number is, but we do know it just gets smaller and smaller with the passage of Father Time, we are losing more and more of the gentlemen that you researched and maybe talked to from this generation, the greatest generation. It's good that we have books like yours and these oral histories now where some of these older folks are, actually interviewed and they record their reminiscences on tape for people to hear in the generations to come.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right, Paul. Our greatest generation is passing quickly. There are very few of them left. When I wrote this book, started writing it in 2020 when I started the research for this, I could not find a living veteran in the 60th. Found lots of family members. My previous book, I actually got to meet and speak with and interview several World War II members. That book was on the 314th Troop Carrier Group. But this book was kind of more of a challenge because I'm reading everything firsthand accounts, reports that these men wrote, but I didn't actually get to talk to them. But seeing pictures of them, weaving together the stories from their letters, from the official histories, but also, you know, other things I could find in the National Archives and Air Force records, is just it's neat forensics to try to weave their story together so it can be told.
Colonel, finally, what was it like dealing with some of these extended relatives, kids, grandkids, family members of the men that piloted these planes and maybe the design people, the Air Force brass? I would imagine that a lot of these people were gratified that you wanted to tell this story and maybe honor some of the greatest generation here, maybe thinking, hey, my dad, my grandfather, my uncle, it's too bad more people don't know about this.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Paul, and this is a common theme with all World War II veterans. They didn't talk about what they did. They all just thought they were doing their duty. Most of them didn't even tell their family members. The men would only talk about it when they were around their buddies at unit reunions and stuff. So a lot of times I get information, and family members tell me when I get stuff that I've dug up through archives and official reports, family members are wowed. They had no idea that their father or grandfather did this. They didn't. It's just amazing. So I'm helping them out too.
And maybe, Colonel, it was their way of maybe dealing with it, right? I've heard that, like, I'm going to leave that there. I don't want to talk about it, because they saw some pretty grisly things over there. I mean, it may have been decades and decades ago, but right, war is war.
A war is hell. Yeah, it sure is. And you're exactly right. These men, they saw horrific things. They saw their buddies blown out of the sky. They evacuated wounded men from the battlefield, another great mission of the C-47, which continues on today in our Air Force, the aeromedical evacuation mission. C-47s help save lives by getting men from the battlefield to the first combat field hospital and then on to long-term care. But you're exactly right. The men were quiet. They didn't want to brag. They just thought they were all doing what needed to be done, ridding the world of tyranny. You know, they were very patriotic. They all wanted to go. They didn't hesitate to go. But when they came home, they just wanted to get on with their lives and build the country, you know, get educated, go back to school, and build the country.
Finally, Colonel, you say the plane is still in use in some form, the C-47. Any word or idea of mothballing it in the future years? I mean, I guess it's going to have to be eventually replaced, but any word on that or not?
Well, it's interesting. The actual DC-3s that are still flying today are either in, like, South America or maybe up in Alaska that are still in business, besides the ones that obviously are restored for historical purposes, you know, for air shows and things. But the plane is still flying. It's still doing its cargo mission because it can get into short runways and airfields, austere locations. It's still a valuable aircraft in some third world countries. Our Air Force doesn't fly it anymore. But again, it's a great design that's just still flying and very safe and reliable.
The book, Leading the Way to Victory, A History of the 60th Troop Carrier Group, 1940 to 1945. The author, Colonel Mark C. Vlahos, retired from the USAF, the Air Force. Colonel, thank you. We appreciate it. Good luck with the book, and I'm going to have to pick this one up myself. Thank you, Colonel. Appreciate it. We'll talk down the road.
Hey, thank you so much. I really enjoyed having on your show today, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel.